Thanks for asking me to give a talk. As Raphael pointed out, I have somewhat narrowed the scope in part because I, as I was writing the slides, I realized otherwise we'd be here till like 3 p.m. And so we wanted to actually learn something specific. I thought I'd go through this particular mechanism, which is one that I've been working on for several years that I think is interesting and understudied, and we'll talk about more detail about that. But first, so why are we interested in baryogenesis? So if we think about sort of puzzles in the Standard Model or clues given to us by cosmology about where new physics can lie, the main things where we really have to have some new dynamics or new states is for dark matter, where we heard a nice talk by Yang. Neutrino oscillations, where Lisa gave a great overview and models for generating neutrino masses and neutrino oscillations. And of course, the matter-antimatter asymmetry, which we haven't yet heard about, except sort of in passing in the context of some neutrino mass models. And so, you know, this is a real big sign from cosmology that we need to have some new particles and things that we don't understand currently. And as we'll see, that often solutions to the baryon asymmetry connect to the other things that we might want to resolve. So how does baryogenesis work? So baryogenesis theories are typically quite restrictive, unlike dark matter models and neutrino models, where it's relatively easy to get it to work out. Anyone who's worked on baryogenesis will know that usually it doesn't work out. And the reason is that there are a set of criteria that we have to satisfy, which was just elaborated by Sakharov. So the first one is baryon number violation. We obviously need some mechanism to change baryons into antibaryons. And this actually does happen in the Standard Model, because in the Standard Model, baryon number is anomalous. It's only the combination baryon number minus lepton number that's preserved. And so, for instance, transitions between different electroweak vacua can transform baryon number into lepton number. So that is something that actually is there in the Standard Model and that we can make use of. The next thing that we need is CP violation, which is basically telling us we need to somehow distinguish between matter and antimatter. If they're on the same footing, I'm never going to get more of one or the other. And in the Standard Model, this was the subject of the Nobel Prize, it seems recently, but it was actually 10 years ago, that in order to get CP violation in the Standard Model, you need to have three generations of quarks. And so physically, what this means, if I want to draw a diagram that leads to CP violation, I need to have all three generations in that diagram somehow. And that generally leads to very suppressed CP asymmetries. And the baryon asymmetry that we're trying to explain, which is about, you know, one extra proton relative to antiprotons in 10 to the 10, the CP violation we see is actually still not enough, and no one's really been able to construct a viable model that makes exclusive use of CP violations in the Standard Model. So this is something that is telling us that we need something new. The last one, which is perhaps the most restrictive, is a departure from equilibrium. And this has two parts to it. One of them is that there needs to be a difference in some particle abundance from its equilibrium abundance. And Steven Weinberg showed that unitarity of CPT cause CP violating rates to vanish if everything is in equilibrium. And this is basically just a statement that you need some error of time. If everything is in equilibrium, you don't know whether you should go forward or backwards. So you need some kind of gradient that's going to drive you in one particular direction. The other thing, so this is in order to generate an asymmetry. Then once we have an asymmetry, we need to make sure that it sticks around. And so if baryon number violating processes happen too fast and enter equilibrium, then that will destroy the asymmetry we've constructed. So both of those pieces have to fall into place. And if you think about in the Standard Model, ways in which you'd have some dramatic kind of departure from equilibrium, there isn't one. The main candidate would have been if there was a first order electroweak phase transition. But of course, you know, that was ruled out two or three decades ago or so, with constraints on the Higgs mass. Right? And so basically, everything in the Standard Model abundances basically stay in equilibrium over the relevant time scale, so that's also out. So new models have to incorporate all of these things, and especially these latter two, which are the most important. Now, if we look at what models of baryogenesis exist, this is obviously a selection, somewhat biased, so if you have written down a model of baryogenesis not up there, hopefully you won't get too mad at me. But I tried to get a selection that covers different energy scale slash mass ranges, as well as different dynamical mechanisms, ranging from what we might call high scale, where the dynamics is happening, say, up near where inflation is happening, or the gut scale, so gut baryogenesis, or these latter two, where you can generate symmetry through some scalar dynamics that's happening in the early universe. Then as we sort of go down from high scale to low scale, around 10 to the 10 GeV, we might have what we may call standard thermal leptogenesis. This is the leptogenesis scenario proposed originally, where I have some right-handed neutrino states that Lisa talked about, and they are out of equilibrium, and they decay more into antileptons than leptons. Okay. Then as we go down, we start hitting some perhaps more interesting scales from the point of view of phenomenology. And around the TV scale, there are three that are most commonly looked at. One of them is resonant leptogenesis, which is basically you still have these neutrino states that are decaying, but the asymmetry you naively get isn't big enough, and so you have to rely on some degeneracy of parameters and some resonant enhancements in order to boost the size of the asymmetry. It's basically saying the asymmetry doesn't want to be the size that we see, and you need to adjust some parameters to make it bigger. Another very popular one is electric baryogenesis, where you change couplings to the Higgs field so that you do get a strongly first-order phase transition, and you add some new sources of CP violation. And so in that phase transition, bubble nucleation, and so on, particle reflection and transmission off the bubble walls, you can generate an asymmetry through this very sort of violent and non-equilibrium process in a first-order phase transition. That is a whole talk of its own, and I actually haven't ever really worked on electric baryogenesis, but if there are questions about any of these later at the end of the talk, say I'm happy to talk with you about what I know about any of these. I added an interesting one that has been worked on recently, which is a proposal by Ann Nelson, Shady Epak, David McKean, and collaborators, where we have baryogenesis through the decays of mesons, and this happens at the GeV scale. And the models are a little bit interesting. They're essentially there so that in case you have very low reheat scales, like 20 MeV, but you reheat through decays of, say, the inflaton or the decay of some modulus into B quarks, you make B mesons and they decay out of equilibrium. So if you have models that are very low reheat, I'd be happy to talk more about that. The one I'm going to be focusing on is so-called Friesen or oscillation leptogenesis or baryogenesis, where you have new states that are lying around the GeV, tens of GeV, 100 GeV, and their dynamics generate the asymmetry through a sort of slow production process and then subsequent rescattering. So the cartoon picture is that you have some singlet particles, which I'll call chi, and there's some process that makes them. It could be a decay, it could be a scattering. And they couple very weakly to everything. So they're made, and then they just kind of march along. And then at some later time, they rescatter. And because they're not talking to anything else, this propagation is coherent. And when you combine the production and destruction processes, you can generate an asymmetry. And I'll go into much more detail about how that works. Why study this? Well, the first is that the model itself is very simple. So it turns out that the seesaw mechanism that Lisa talked about is sufficient to get leptogenesis through this mechanism. Or in basically any Friesen dark matter model, or most of Friesen dark matter models, you automatically have the ingredients to generate the baryon asymmetry. So we're talking like a couple of new fields. I would say that it's been understudied given the simplicity, and I think that part of it is that the actual dynamical mechanism is a little bit involved to go through. There is essentially one limit that's been very well studied, which is called the neutrino minimal standard model. And this is a scenario where you add some right-handed neutrinos and nothing else, and you rely on those right-handed neutrinos to do everything for you. This is sort of very popular among individuals who highly value minimality, meaning I want to add as few new particles to the standard model as possible. And so basically you just add two chis and then couple them and you're done. However, the dynamical mechanism can work as well in models that have like one extra particle. So if you're not too concerned about that one extra particle, then maybe we want to actually study what those limits are, and they can give very different phenomenology or ways in which the asymmetry is generated. And I would say that in some cases, some of the limits that we're studying, sort of the asymmetry, dare I say, kind of works out a little bit more naturally or easily than you might in this one particular limit that's been well studied. Another thing is because the dynamics are rich, you naturally get a bunch of scales out of the theory. So you have TeV scales coming in through the electric phase transition and stuff that's going on there. As we'll see, the KeV mass scale pops out as the sort of oscillation scale of the typical propagation of these states that you want. And you also generate centimeter scales, which are interesting from the point of view of phenomenology if you come with a collider. And it's also testable in a sort of irreducible sense. You always have states that are low in mass and that you can produce. And so that's beneficial from the point of view of actually testing it. So what is the model? This is the Lagrangian. So there's a psi, a phi, and a chi. Psi is a standard model field, okay? Quark or lepton. I'll be agnostic for the first little bit because it actually doesn't matter. And there are three flavors of those. We already know that. Okay, so this is something that is in the standard model already. We have these singlets, and as we'll see, in order to have the proper interference effects that give you CP violation, you need two of them at least. And they have some masses. And then we need to have some scalar fields, the one or more of them, and we'll see in a little while where the different numbers of scalar fields can change how the asymmetry is generated. And just in order to make it work, this has to have the same gauge charge as the fermion field. So you see, for instance, that if I make psi a lepton doublet, phi could be the standard model Higgs. So both psi and phi would be standard model particles, and the singlets are just the things that I have to add. So it's a relatively small number of choices that we have to make. There are lots of different possible choices, but for now I'm going to choose a scenario that we looked at most in our study where we have a Z2 symmetry that the chi and the phi are charged under. And so that makes chi a dark matter candidate. And it means that this phi has to be some new scalar because the standard model Higgs would not preserve that Z2 symmetry. We'll talk later about what happens if we look at the opposite case. So, for instance, if the psi's are quarks, then phi would carry some Baryon number because of the Z2 symmetry. So, dynamically, what's going on? So, let's start with the dark matter picture because it's actually easier, and we'll see that we naturally get dark matter to work in this scenario. So, the mechanism is Friesen. For those of you who haven't heard the term before and need a bit of a refresher, Friesen is just a fancy word for I have some slow production of something. So, for instance, I have the phi particle, it can decay into psi and chi. And chi is a singlet, so this is its only interaction. So, as phi decays in the early universe, the x-axis, as we go to the right, is later times or lower temperatures. The decays just start accumulating these chi particles. So, on the y-axis, we see the abundance, and the abundance just sort of grows. And then at a certain point, it flattens out. And that's because as we'll see, this is the mass of phi over the temperature, so when the universe cools below the typical scale of the phi, it just decays away, there's not much left, and you stop making the chi. And so assuming this is slow enough, you just make, you kind of adjust the coupling, so you make just the right amount of it, and then that's the amount that just stays around forever. As you increase the rate of interaction, you make more of it, and so you get more dark matter. So it's the opposite of freeze-out if you're used to that, where more interactions give you less. And just looking at some parametrics here, if I want to assume the dark matter abundance, and I want my dark matter mass to be sort of order 10 keV, which is probably about as low as we could go to be consistent with structure formation constraints, and I put the mass of the scalar at, say, TeV, which is safe from collider constraints, this coupling has to be really small, like 10 to the minus 8. And that's just because the expansion rate of the universe is not that fast. So in order to make it so that it's this very slow rate of accumulation, we need very, very tiny couplings. So this is generally bad from the point of view of observability because we have these really small couplings. But I have this scalar that carries gauge charge. And it's also good from the point of view of baryogenesis because I'm out of equilibrium the whole time I'm doing it. Okay, so what about the generation of the asymmetry? It turns out, like, yes.
Yeah. So for this coupling, what's the lifetime of the phi particle?
Centimeters.
Okay, yeah. That's what it is.
But we'll see that it actually, like, you have to have a coupling of that size for other reasons as well. Now, in Friesen, there's no reason why this phi has to be TeV and why this chi has to be 10 keV. So in Friesen models, often people will put in these numbers because they'll say, well, I want to have something that maybe the LHC can see, and then I want to make the coupling sort of big enough that it decays inside of my detector. And so those are the choices that I get. But there's nothing that's stopping me from making chi 1 MeV and phi 10 to the 5 TeV, let's say. So what's different about this is that we'll see that requiring the Baryon asymmetry puts a pretty hard cutoff on what the values of those masses can be. Okay, so I'll go in steps through sort of all of the different pieces because, like I said, there's a bunch of different scales and a bunch of things going on. Feel free to ask questions if it gets a little bit too muddled. I'm happy to go over it. Okay, so how does the generation of the asymmetry work? So the process is as follows. The first step looks just like Friesen. I have a phi, which decays into my standard model particle and a singlet. And then the singlet subsequently inverse decays off of a different standard model particle back into phi. Okay. But because this process is happening very slowly, these points are actually like at distinct places and distinct times. And what's interesting is that if I have two singlets, then I have two of these processes. And my claim is that if I consider the interference of these two diagrams and square it, where I take these happening at different times, I can get an asymmetry. And so in order to explain why that is and why certain things show up in the rates, I want to just do a short refresher on how we get CP violation. What are the minimal ingredients? Yes.
So you don't need interference between tree level and loop level because you have two symmetries. So you get everything at the tree level, is that?
Good. So the question is, do we need tree and loop? So often the loop so what we actually need is a phase that's going to come out of this explanation. And often that phase comes from the optical theorem where I have a loop where things go on shell and I have certain eyes that pop up. As we'll see, the phase actually comes from this propagation phase. So I don't actually need the loop because I don't need an imaginary part of that forward scattering process. Okay, so what I want in CP violation is to have some initial state go to a final state and have that be different from the anti-initial state go to the anti-initial final state. And in field theory, these are fields are related by Hermitian conjugation. So the natural thing to try is to say, well, let's just put something with a phase and then have something with opposite phase. Of course, overall phases in quantum mechanics don't give you anything, so I get no asymmetry. So you can say, well, let me try to have different terms in my amplitude so that when I interfere them, I also get that. So we can try writing down something more involved, where I have a term with a phase plus another term. And when I take the complex conjugate, I get e to the minus I phi instead of e to the I phi. And if you calculate the difference in the matrix element squares, you still get zero. Okay, and the reason is that I get a cosine of phi when I do the absolute value squared, and cos of phi is equal to cos of minus phi, and that's also zero. So it's actually not enough to have some phase in my matrix element that changes sign under complex conjugation. Turns out what I need are two phases, one which we call phi here, which changes sign under complex conjugation. The other, this theta, is the same for both the particle and the antiparticle process. Okay, so we often hear about CP odd and CP even phases. Now if I take this, this is just a mathematical thing, I take the absolute value squared and subtract, and what I find is the result depends on both of these two phases. So I need it's some coupling in my theory that when I go to the antiparticle, I take the complex conjugate, and I need some other phase that's the same for both particles and antiparticles. So let's go back to our process. So I have these two processes. One is with this intermediate chi1 particle. The second is the intermediate chi2 particle. And these have phases that arise from the Yukawa couplings of the vertices, but they also have a phase just from propagation. This one has energy E1, and so I get an e to the minus I omega 1t from the Schrodinger equation. This one, I get an e to the minus I omega 2t. This is a slightly oversimplistic picture, but it's basically what happens. And these phases are the same for particles and antiparticles. It's not like the Schrodinger equation has flips the sign on the I just because I have a different state. And energy is an energy. And so I end up with two phases, one that comes from the Yukawa couplings and one that comes from this propagation. And so the difference of these propagation phases is going to be of crucial importance to generating asymmetry and is going to tell us basically how big and what the relevant timescales of generating the asymmetry are. So what are these phases? Well, of course, an absolute phase doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is the difference of phases. So if I have a relativistic chi particle, then if I take the difference of these, the leading term, which is the momentum, cancels. And so what I end up with is an m squared over 2, the momentum. And so the difference in phases is going to go like the difference of mass squares of these two states, okay, which is going to be familiar. This is just neutrino oscillations, right? Except instead of neutrinos, it's some chi particle. And so what I can do is I can get differences in the particle rates versus antiparticle rates. So for instance, I can have the rate of standard model particle hitting phi going to standard model particle potentially of a different flavor going to phi minus the antiparticle process. And it's going to go like the imaginary part of a bunch of these couplings, which is the phase that flips sign when you go from particles to antiparticles, and then the sign of this oscillation phase that accumulates over time.
I mean, you also have a distribution of momenta, or how should I think of the momenta? Because this might well average to zero.
Yes, so we actually keep track of, so we do it for each momentum state separately, and then you do, we sum over all of these processes for each different momentum mode, essentially. Okay, so yes?
Perhaps a basic question, but if I'm thinking of the chi's as not, you know, just virtual particles because they're long-lived, these are really on shell, I mean, should there be some, do I have to care about a difference in propagation time? Or they have essentially the same interaction, so on average?
Good, so there's a lot of things you can potentially worry about here. So all of this is only in the limit where the momentum is much, much bigger than the mass. So the way you can get away with it is that there's some uncertainty in the energy of this creation process, okay? Because phi is some blip, and you know it's made and it's destroyed in the plasma. And so you know the delta E, delta T uncertainty principle says there's some distribution of energies of each of these particles. So if you do the proper wave packet convolution, you can basically show that there's interference. Now, if you wait too long, like, for instance, as you say, if one is actually going faster than the other, I can get what's called positional decoherence, which is that, like, the wave packets just spread out. And on the time scales that are the oscillation time scales, that's not important. If you try to go way much beyond that, then you might get into those issues, but as we'll see, the asymmetry generation shuts off then anyway. Yes?
So the reason we don't worry about the this phase in usual leptogenesis models is because those are much they're much less
long-lived, is that? You can think of that, so you have, the usual calculation is assuming something's happening at a particular instant of time, right? So it's a usual kind of scattering or decay where I take some asymptotic states and everything's very localized in position and time. So there isn't essentially time to accumulate these phases because you don't have the real particles propagating. But here, these things can live for like order Hubble, generally. I mean, they generally live actually for much longer than that because, as we know, these chi's are out of equilibrium. So most of them just won't scatter off of anything. Most of them just keep going. Okay, so this at least gives us a CP asymmetry, a difference between particle and antiparticle rates. It doesn't necessarily give us a baryon asymmetry. And one way that we can see that is that, you know, the way I drew the diagram was I had phi decay into psi alpha and then psi beta collide with a chi. But I could have had psi decay into psi beta and chi and psi alpha come in and collide. Right? Both of those are things that contribute to this process. And you can see that the Yukawa couplings are the same except I just flip the role of alpha and beta. Okay. When I take the interference of the various processes, what I end up with is I sum over some set of couplings and their complex conjugate, which gives me something real, and so this imaginary part actually is zero. So if the masses of psi alpha and psi beta are the same, as is true, you know, for most standard model particles in the early universe, when I add up all of these processes, so if I look at myself with just one process, I get an asymmetry. If I add up over all the processes, it's zero. This is also a cautionary tale. Anytime you're doing baryogenesis, you should be careful you're adding up over all of the relevant processes. So why am I giving the talk? Well, of course, there are loopholes to this argument, and so let's talk about some of those. One of the ways is if we have two scalars. So if I have two scalars, such that my process is, say, phi 1 decays at first into psi alpha and chi, and then they recombine into a psi 2, if I flip the order, there's actually a different coupling that shows up. Like here it's F1 alpha, F2 beta. Here it's F1 beta, F2 alpha. And so that combination of couplings no longer vanishes. So basically just saying that there wasn't actually a physical CP phase in the other process. Okay. So the asymmetry no longer cancels when you sum over the flavors. Good. Now, you have to be careful because there's another process that you care about, which is if I swap the phi 1 and the phi 2, right? Because there's nothing in asymmetry that said, like, makes it so it has to be the phi 1 decays at first. So I can reverse the order of these. And in particular, in zero temperature field theory, you know, in no expanding background, these processes are related by CPT symmetry, where I flip the order, I put bars on everything, and the rates have to be the same. Okay. So in a non-expanding space-time, you also get a canceling asymmetry. However, because these processes are happening at different times, the universe is actually expanding in between that, and you are explicitly violating Lorentz invariance. And CPT invariance no longer gives a cancellation because it only relates things that are happening at a particular time to one another. So one way we can see that is, let's say that there's some time T1 where the first process happens, or equivalent to some temperature, I'm assuming radiation domination. So I have some temperature T1 up here, some temperature T2 down there. Let's just, for the sake of argument, assume that phi 2 is much heavier than phi 1. If that's the case, the first temperature sort of comparable to the phi 2 mass, both of these processes can happen unsuppressed. Then I wait a long time, everything redshifts, the typical energy scale goes down. Now my temperature T2 is much lower than the phi 2 mass. This process is shut off because I just don't have enough energy. It's Boltzmann suppressed. This one is not. So I can just explicitly get a difference in rates, and it's because of the fact that the expansion is changing the energy distribution, and some processes that were allowed are not anymore. So at any given moment in time, CPT is preserved, and we've checked in the calculations that if you, say, set the Hubble expansion to zero, all the asymmetries cancel. So you can actually get a non-zero asymmetry in the case where I have two scalars. Okay. So my minimal model now is I have two scalars, two chi's, and some standard model fields, and I can generate an asymmetry. All right, so we've generated an asymmetry. I want to make sure it survives. And when we think about this, you realize that I've been sort of sweeping some issues under the rug, which is that my symmetry preserves an exact B minus L symmetry. Standard model fermion carries a B minus L charge. Phi also carries the same B minus L charge. So if I generate an asymmetry, say, in quarks, the only way that that can be possible is if I generate an opposite asymmetry. I've made them sort of red and blue for, like, say, hot and cold or positive or negative or something. I've created an opposite asymmetry in the scalar fields. And these scalars aren't around anymore, and so at some point they're going to decay. And when they decay, that asymmetry is going to wipe out the standard model fermion asymmetry. So that also seems bad. And that would be true in the standard model if baryon number and lepton number were separately preserved. But in the standard model, once I, let's say, psi is a quark, I make some asymmetry in quarks, it doesn't stay there because the standard model at high scales violates baryon number, and it violates lepton number and only preserves B minus L. So what actually happens is that this asymmetry gets split between quarks and leptons. And then let's assume that these phis, they take a long time to decay, which they need to by these small couplings. And so we wait and wait, and then eventually the electroweak phase transition happens. Sphalerons that are active above the weak scale are no longer active, and so quarks and leptons become decoupled. So let's just shove, say, leptons over here. Now the phi particles can decay into quarks, but that doesn't matter because the asymmetries no longer line up. So I'm going to end up with equal and opposite quark and lepton asymmetries. But the precondition was that this phi particle had to stick around long enough that this decoupling happened. If it happened now, before the electric phase transition, I get no asymmetry. If it happens after the electric phase transition, I have an asymmetry. So that puts quite stringent constraints on what, for instance, the decay width of at least one of these phi particles is. We are forced to have that for one of them, at least, the decay width is smaller than Hubble at the electroweak temperature. And if you plug in the numbers, what you find is that the lifetime is about 1 centimeter, which is sort of interesting. So for baryogenesis to work, at least one scalar has to have a macroscopic lifetime, like on macroscopic scales that we are accustomed to. This coincidence sort of popped up in various ways. This is probably the most direct way of linking a particle lifetime to the Hubble expansion rate at the electroweak phase transition that I've ever seen. Like, usually you have to say, well, let's say I want something happening at a TeV. But here it's like, this is really the electroweak temperature, because that's the scale at which the baryon and lepton numbers decouple from one another. Okay, so we've seen that we can generate asymmetry and we can keep it provided that the scalar obeys this long lifetime, but we've already said that's roughly the lifetime we expect for Friesen dark matter, so that's promising. How big is the asymmetry and how do the parameters control the size of the asymmetry? So here's the expression that I had for an asymmetry in rates. It goes like the imaginary part of the fourth power of Yukawa. So this is suppressed compared to, say, the dark matter creation rate. And then the sine of this piece. And the momentum p is redshifting. So that's getting smaller. So you can think of this as an oscillation where the oscillation frequency is increasing. And so what I end up with is something that looks like this, where I've deliberately left off any numbers, but we just have some time. And then, you know, once this quantity is comparable to Hubble, you start oscillating, and then you oscillate very, very quickly. So what this says is that at late times, the asymmetry is flipping between positive and negative generation very, very fast. And what that means is when I take a time average, it's zero. But I have this, if I integrate this whole distribution, I don't get zero because of this sort of slow piece here. So most of the asymmetry is generated there, where the mass splitting over, now for kind of sloppiness, I'm just going to make p comparable to t, although as I say, we actually keep track of all of the momentum mode separately, when this is comparable to Hubble. And the maximum phase is always one, it's just a sine of something. So the size of the asymmetry I get is the integral of this rate over here. And basically, the more I stretch out this function, the longer the integration time I have, the bigger the asymmetry I get. So when you actually evaluate this integral analytically, what you typically find is that the asymmetry is proportional to 1 over this delta m squared to some positive power. So in the case of all of the reaction rates are sort of relativistic, there's no masses in the series, that power is 2/3. In the case where you have some massive particles decaying, it's 1. But the point is that you want to delay the oscillations as long as possible so that this integral becomes as big as possible. Or at least that's the parameter that optimizes the asymmetry. So you can say, well, how late do we want to delay the oscillations? I certainly don't want to delay the oscillations past the electroweak phase transition time, because then, as we've argued, it doesn't work. So the optimal asymmetry is typically when this delta m squared over the electroweak is comparable to Hubble at the electroweak scale. And when you plug those numbers in, you find that the asymmetry is optimized if your mass splitting squared is about 5 keV squared. So again, the dynamics have sort of picked out some scale that's not the mass scale of any particular thing. It's the square of the differences of the masses. That temperature where this is happening is all much bigger than keV, but I need to have this mass splitting. Okay, so what this tells us, just like neutrino oscillation experiments, is sort of the optimal mass splittings. However, what we see is that this is mass splitting squared is most naturally realized when all of the masses are comparable to that. So we just automatically get that. So we're kind of casting a spotlight on 10 keV masses for this singlet slash dark matter. And this is also, it turns out, optimal for dark matter. It's heavy enough. You know, 10 or 12 is heavy enough to be consistent with small-scale structure, especially since dark matter is being produced at, say, TeV temperatures, so it's a little bit colder than it would be if it were produced at low mass. But it's also light enough to not have an overdensity. Remember that the dark matter production is at order F squared, and baryon production is at order F to the fourth. So I have typically I overpredict dark matter relative to baryons, and so the lighter I can make the dark matter, I have more of the particles around it. It makes it more consistent. So you may be sort of horrified potentially by all of the different pieces or the different dynamical things that have to come into it. But I want to emphasize the model itself is very simple. It's just like two singlets and a scalar or two. Okay? The mechanism is subtle. So if you actually want to get the asymmetry right, then you need to take into account all these factors. But you naturally get these different scales that are popping out of a model that doesn't seem to have any of those scales in it, right? Which is why I think it's both interesting and viable and testable. Okay, so what are some of the numerical results that we've gotten? So I've been vague so far about what all of these things are, so I'm going to make it somewhat more concrete by making an arbitrary choice. We make the standard model particle the right-handed quarks, up-type quarks. Why? One of our things that we're interested in seeing is what's the biggest available parameter space, just because when we say the model is testable, we want to be able to quantify that in some way. And it turns out because of the chemical potential relationships, this tends to give you a somewhat bigger asymmetry than you get if you pick the other choices of quarks. We also picked quarks because basically no one's looked at this model in quarks. The only scenario that's really been tested is this sort of right-handed neutrino leptogenesis standard model Higgs scenario. So because this is freeze-in and the couplings are small, the calculation can actually be done perturbatively, and what we present is a perturbative calculation of the results. And we've confirmed with numerical solutions of the density matrix and checking various approximations that that gets you right about 30% of the asymmetry slash dark matter final results. In the results I'm showing, we're basically ignoring thermal masses and washout effects, quantum statistics, and so on. And I have backup slides if you want. I can show you that they're not particularly important for the things that I'm showing. So this is what a sort of result plot looks like. So we wanted to present things in terms of phenomenological parameters as much as possible. So in this scenario, we've picked the two scalar masses. One of them is 2 TeV, one of them is 4 TeV. We've picked one of the singlets to have a zero mass, one of them to be 20 keV. Because it's produced at a high scale, the N effective, even if you had an equilibrium abundance, even though you typically don't have an equilibrium abundance of these chis, would give you an N effective of like 0.5. So it's sort of safe, but potentially detectable. So the red contours give us the ratio of the dark matter abundance to, sorry, the chi abundance to the observed dark matter abundance. So this curve is 1/10, this is 1, and this is 10. Right? So for dark matter, we really want to be spot on. Okay. The blue curves are the ratio of the barren asymmetry that we generate over the observed one, and this is the maximum one that can be obtained in the model. The reason why that's okay is that you can always adjust the CP phases to make the asymmetry smaller, so it's okay if you have sort of a bigger number for the barren asymmetry. So this is 1, this is 10, this is 100. So you see we have this nice wedge of parameter space that works, and it's big enough that we trust all of our numerical calculations and everything, but small enough to actually be relatively constrained. If we go too far up to the right, we get dark matters overproduced. If we go down to the left, we get too few baryons. And if you look, it's a little bit hard to see, but in this wedge, the lifetimes are sort of 1 to 100 centimeters for the scalars. Okay. So, and we haven't really had to fiddle with anything. You know, there's a bunch of mixing angles that I haven't defined, but they're all set to be like point something, 0.3 pi over whatever, okay? So we're not tuning things, we're not making things degenerate, it's just if I just plug in numbers, it kind of pops out, and I get both dark matter and the barren asymmetry, which is not what you normally get naturally in these sorts of scenarios. Now, there's an interesting way of thinking about this mechanism and potentially other implications, which is that the second scalar can be heavy, and it can actually be so heavy as to be decoupled at the time of the second scattering. So what we did was we took, again, our lightest scalar mass to be 2 TeV, but then we changed the mass of the heavier scalar, 2.1, 3, 4. This solid curve is 20, and you can see that they converge on a certain baryon asymmetry. Okay, once again, this is the dark matter abundance, and so we have some kind of a wedge that's viable here. The requirement is that the amount of dark matter that you get from the phi 2 decay has to be held fixed. So what this means is as I pull up the mass of the heavier scalar, I also increase the couplings, the second scalar, because the Hubble scale is higher at its mass. And as long as I scale all of those things so that they scale the same way, I converge to some solution on the baryon asymmetry. So what does this mean? It basically means that this first part is separate from the second part. I have some process which makes a bunch of singlets. They propagate coherently. Then at some much later time, they scatter where I sort of lost memory of what's going on. So if you want, and you know, particularly if you're working on inflation or reheating, preheating, that sort of thing, I can just replace all of this with some blob. Okay? Anytime I have out of equilibrium dynamics in the early universe that makes a bunch of these chis that are not their equilibrium abundance, and that they don't talk to anything as that propagation happens, then this later time collision can produce an asymmetry. So, you know, we, not being people who work on reheating and preheating, didn't sort of want to go too far down that path, but I think it's an interesting thought that, you know, if you have some scenario where you generally tend to, you know, you reheat the standard model and then you have some subdominant population of singlets, then you kind of naturally realize this kind of barrier genesis. So people have ideas, and I'm happy to hear that. So what we did before was pick particular parameters and then try to see where it works with those particular masses, say, or those particular mixing angles. For a phenomenological point of view, we wanted to get some sense of, like, can I always just make the scalar, light a scalar as heavy as I want, or am I restricted to some range? So what we did is we did some scans over the parameter space where we fixed basically the mixing angles in some, actually, that's not true. We didn't do that for the scans. What we did for the curves was we fixed the mixing angle and we analytically optimized. We said, okay, subject to these constraints, what's the biggest baryon asymmetry you can get? And we plotted the region where you get a baryon asymmetry. So for instance, if both of the scalars talk equally to the chi1 and the chi2, I kind of have this blob where I see that as the biggest possible mass I can get is, say, 3 or 4 TeV. And if I sort of align my parameters in optimal ways, I can maybe push out to larger values. Okay. We then did scans where we just drew things from various distributions. And then subject to those parameters that we picked, we found the other parameters that optimized the baryon asymmetry to try to get a sense of, like, where are we actually seeing things. I wouldn't take the probability distributions too seriously, because, of course, we don't have any sense of how these would be drawn. But the two things we wanted to consider were an anarchic Yukawa matrix. So basically, for this F matrix, I pick a number, let's say 10 to the minus 8 times 1.3 or something. Okay. Then, and that's done on a log scale, then each of the entries is some order one number times that. Okay, so I end up with entries that are all roughly comparable. And you see that the population of the scans is basically contained within this roughly equal mixing angle. So they don't have to be exactly equal, but if they're all roughly the same size, then you populate this space. The other thing that we did was we said, let's draw each individual coupling on a log scale. So let's say that within this matrix, I could have a coupling that's 10 to the minus 6, and one that's 10 to the minus 12, and I don't care. And if you do that, you see the parameter space is greatly expanded. And the reason is essentially that you tend to overproduce dark matter. But because we have a massless state, you can find alignments where you're mostly dumping kind of energy density into that massless chi1 rather than into the heavier chi2. So there's a trade-off between baryogenesis. I want everything to be mixing, and the dark matter overproduction. And you can see that if we sort of, this blue curve is if I put, I basically reach an equilibrium abundance of the chi1 particle, I analytically determine that this is my parameter space. And what we see is that the scans sort of populate that. Okay. But it's, this is on a log scale, so really still we're finding most of the points lying at this low mass. So what's neat about this for me is that it's very rare in a baryogenesis model. The only other one I can really think of is electric baryogenesis, where there's like an actual closed contour. Like, you cannot go past that line, right? Because otherwise you just cannot satisfy all of the requirements. So this makes it very testable. Right. So what happens if the lightest particle is not massless? Then there are even tighter constraints, because either it's like a warm dark matter if it's less than 10 keV, and there are restrictions on how much of that there can be. And so what we find is, so for instance, if the lightest chi mass is half of the mass of the heavier one, we're sort of restricted to like less than 2 or 2.5 TeV in mass. So this plot shows the chi mass dependence versus the mass of the scalar. And once again, this is sort of the blue are what we might consider sort of the most reasonable choices. The red are what we might consider tuning the couplings to give you the biggest possible asymmetry. So you can see that if I really work hard, I can get the mass of the scalar up to about 20 TeV. And we see a correlation between the mass of the chi particle and the mass of the phi, and the reason is that the heavier phi is, I want oscillations to happen earlier so that it's sort of before that time scale, and that pushes me to larger chi masses, essentially. Okay, so that should hopefully convince you that this is a viable mechanism. It's relatively straightforward. We didn't have to do much with the parameters. You might say, well, what if there's only a single scalar? So give up on the two scalar. Maybe you want to be more minimal and just have one. Okay, and in particular, this is relevant for the case of, say, leptogenesis, where we only have one scalar, which is a standard model case. Okay, so the argument that we made before was that if the masses of the quarks are the same, that I can switch the order at which they're being put in, and that flips what these Yukawa couplings are. And if the whole rate causes me to factor out those Yukawa couplings and everything else is independent of the masses, then I end up with something real when I combine those Yukawa couplings. But not everything is massless. So in particular, in the unbroken phase, all the fields acquire thermal masses from interactions with the plasma. And the top quark, for instance, has a bigger thermal mass than the other quarks. And so that actually can lead to differences in these rates. Okay, and it just has to do with the fact that the phase space of the processes changes depending on the temperature and sort of the relative mass of phi and the relative mass of the top at that particular point in time. This is going to be of higher order. The top thermal mass goes like Yukawa top squared. So what we end up with is something that's at order f to the fourth Yukawa top squared. So this two-scalar model worked over a pretty broad range. A single-scalar model works, but it's over a much more constrained range. So this is the mass of the chi 2. This is the maximum baryon asymmetry over the observed one. And you can see that once we're at scalar masses of 2.5, we really can't do baryogenesis anymore. Okay. So this model is even more testable and basically can be ruled out with the high luminosity LHC. Maybe I'll show this next, which is that if the top quark doesn't couple, so if we're unlucky in some sense, then the asymmetry just comes fully at the next order f to the 6, and I have to construct a series of three scattering processes, which is more complicated. This CP-violating source was actually first noted by some folks who were working on the leptogenesis scenario, but was never actually independently studied, because in their model, this was never sort of the dominant piece, the one that we saw. The other thing is that you need three chi particles instead of two in that case. So you sort of swap a scalar for a chi. And in this model, you actually cannot, subject to the dark matter constraints, explain the baryon asymmetry. So you sort of have to pick one or the other. You can still do baryogenesis, but again, the mass of the scalar has to be below about 2 TeV. So it's very testable. This does mean that there are potentially interesting flavor implications, like if you do discover some scalar at mass 1.5 TeV, and you basically top versus not top is an important factor, and top quarks are the one quark that we can reliably very easily distinguish from, say, any light flavor quark. So what are some signals of this? So these things are quite literally long-lived things that go up and then explode in some part of your detector. So the natural place to look is I have some new things that carry standard model gauge charges. On all of the plots that I showed, the lifetime has to exceed 0.1 centimeters or so. So this is firmly in the range of what we call long-lived particles. And it's sort of a weird coincidence, because for several years I have been working very much on long-lived particles. I was one of the two main editors of this long-lived particles community document. And then I was like, I'm fed up with long-lived particles. I'm going to work on baryogenesis. And then it's like, oh, okay. But I'm back excited about long-lived particles. Okay. Turns out that they just pop out of everywhere. Okay. So you don't have to have some contrived motivation. So the process is I collide two protons. I make two of these phi particles. And then after some distance, the phi particle decays to a standard model quark. And a missing dark matter particle. And so the collision points here in the middle, for those of you who are neumologists or haven't seen collider stuff in a long time, this is a cross-section of, for instance, the CMS detector. And what most particles that you're trying to identify, like electrons, muons, photons, are coming from the collision point. Here we have something that goes some distance and kind of blows up in the middle of the detector. And this can do various things, ranging from decay very much in so close to the middle that you can't really tell it apart, to you can still see the particles coming out of the decay, but they just are coming from a funny location or out of time, to sort of more sophisticated things like this phi particle carries electric charge. And so if it makes it most of the way through the detector, it's going to leave ionization signals in funny places. It's going to, again, have funny timing signatures and so on. So if anyone's interested in the specifics, you can, but I found myself going through long-lived particle searches and reinterpreting them. Turns out that actually, scalar going to quark plus missing energy is not really a popular long-lived particle model. I think you get that in gauge mediation, but it's sort of like photon or taus are the ones that people tend to look at. This is sort of one of the things that isn't predicted by, you know, most of the supersymmetric models. There are Gluino long-lived particles that we were, you know, for the most part able to interpret, although there's some places where having the quark interpretation would actually make a significant difference. So this is the lifetime, the mass of the particle. Down here is if it decays immediately, so there's no long-lived signature. Then there's a search for displaced jets, which are basically like, you know, hadrons that are not originating from the interaction point and that form a secondary vertex. And this is probably the one that is the most sensitive to the quark gluon differences, because they rely on the different hadrons coming out of the decay having a large invariant mass. Of course, this quark has zero invariant mass, but of course QCD gives the jet a mass, and that jet mass is going to depend on quark versus gluon. So this actually could be different. Delayed jets, which is done by someone in the audience here, Matthew, where you just wait for, or you study the timing signal and you see that the jet hits later than something that's coming from the collision point should, because of the fact that this particle is heavy and slow. And then you have, for longer lifetimes, this heavy stable charge particle surge. You see the limits are already larger than a TeV or 1.1 TeV and potentially going up to sort of 2.5 TeV range, which would be covering most of the interesting parameter space. Yeah.
So the phi particle, they could hydronize before decay. Mm-hmm. So that may maybe give an additional check for the inner check part. Has that been taken into account for the studies?
Good. So yeah, typically, and in talking to experimentalists, they generally are not too concerned about this, just because often that track would only be a few centimeters, and unless you're looking for track stubs, it wouldn't actually be reconstructed as a track. So it, you know, it's such a busy environment that that would just be something that's not associated with the vertex. So typically, so for instance, this displaced jets signature, they are looking for gluinos that decay to gluon plus invisible, and they hadronize the gluinos and pass the R hadrons to their simulation, and they still get good sensitivity. But if you, you know, another way you could look for that would be like a disappearing track type signature, but that's sort of making your life more hard than it needs to be, because there's very low background for these high invariant mass displaced vertex searches.
So it's a 1 centimeter lifetime of the heavy particle that's slow enough to give a delay jets?
Well, so that's the lower bound on the lifetime. Go back to some of these plots. You see that you can go up to like 100 centimeters or a meter, you know, 10 meters. Okay. So, but you see it cuts off kind of around 1 or 0.1. It turns out that for this, where are we? For the single scalar case, if I drop the dark matter requirement and only look for the baryon asymmetry, I can go into some strong washout limit where I have a bigger coupling, and then I can get prompt decays. But that's a relatively small corner of the parameter space, but we still wanted to show the prompt case on here.
But if it's that delay, then I should already have some tracks or even the
NTO. Right, so that's this one. So depending on the lifetime's longer than about a meter or 10 meters, then the dominant constraint just comes from I have this thing that passes through the detector. But if I have a shorter lifetime, then typically, now this is also kind of, you'll see these curves are very jagged, and that's in part because, you know, I think it's very computationally difficult to like, and slash expensive to get the constraints of the function of mass and cross-section and everything, and so usually there's only a few points. So, you know, I wouldn't trust that, like, it could be like that, but it gives you some sense of where the peak sensitivity is. Okay, some other cosmological and astrophysical signals, we were focusing more on these sort of irreducible signals that seem to come out. But there are a few things. So for instance, the model really prefers low mass dark matter. So for instance, if we look at the output of one of these scans, this is the dark matter mass. Again, I wouldn't take this too seriously, but you see that, you know, you tend to have kind of tens of KeV. So if you're closer to the lower end of that, you could potentially see influence on that in small scale structure. So we see that it could potentially be heavy enough that that's not really seen. Most of the parameter space, just sort of by size, features an almost massless state, okay, that can have a large abundance, because we saw that you can actually, particularly if this phi is heavier, maybe too heavier to be seen, you have this massless state that you're trying to dump energy into, and in order to, you know, have a large chi abundance for baryogenesis, but not contribute to your omega dark matter. So you know that can affect an effective. And then sort of an optional signature that you often get in these sort of KEV things, like if you want an indirect detection signature, if the Z2 is very slightly broken by some high scale effects that we're not including and not relevant for a baryogenesis, you can get X-ray signatures, but it's not a necessary prediction in the model. That would be something that would be there if you're optimistic. So I think for all of these, we could be fortunate and see all of them. We could be unfortunate and see none of them. The collider stuff is a little bit more irreducible.
Yeah. So you have chi1 and chi2, right? Mm-hmm. For some models. So the chi2 potentially can decay to chi1, even z2 is conserved. What's the lifetime of that chi2? Could it be very long?
So typically, so if the chi2 is heavy enough, so typically in this model, if it's above, for instance, like the meson masses, then you could decay into meson plus chi1. Because we're well below that, we don't get any of those.
But you still get a photon. What it means chi2, supposed to be below meson mass, still can decay to chi1 plus photon. So that will also likely potentially give you X-ray signal without the Z2 break, if the chi2 can leave room.
So the chi, quark, phi.
There's some loop process.
Yeah, there's some loop process. So I think it's going to be small because the smallest of the couplings, but we should check that. Yeah, that's a good thing. Thanks. okay, I don't have much time. So fortunately, we've laid the groundwork so that we understand, well, I understand all of the different pieces. Hopefully, you've been able to follow some of it. And we can now talk about the sort of more well-studied one, which there's been extensive studies of the parameter space in terms of the parametrics of what we've already talked about. So this model is basically the seesaw mechanism where we take the standard model particle to be lepton doublet. These chis are now right-handed neutrinos, and the phi is the standard model Higgs. So the Z2 is broken by the standard model. This means that these chis can no longer be dark matter, so basically we've traded dark matter for neutrino masses. You have your pick, which you'd rather have. Okay. This is also a single scalar model, so as we've argued, the asymmetry comes in at order f to the 6th. Okay? It does not come in at order f to the 4th, you call it tau squared for reasons that I can go into if you're interested. How does that work? Basically, the idea is that this process that we argue does not lead to any asymmetry in leptons, doesn't lead to asymmetry in leptons, but it can lead to flavor asymmetry. So it can, for instance, make the rate of mu to electron be different from the rate of anti-muon to anti-electron, positron. So I can get asymmetries in individual flavors, like a positive muon asymmetry and a negative electron asymmetry, such that the sum cancels. So that's the leading order piece. But then there's subsequent scattering that can happen. So for instance, these leptons can further decays of the Higgs or further scatterings can create new chi particles again, and those rates can differ based on the lepton flavor. So for instance, those processes transfer the lepton asymmetry into the hidden particles, but those can be maybe different. So I still have net zero asymmetry, but I sort of sequester them in some way that the standard model leptons acquire an asymmetry that's equal and opposite to the asymmetry in these hidden particles. So that's going to be at order f to the 6th that you get this asymmetry. So it's going to be smaller than in the model we considered. These signals are called n, just because they're right-handed neutrinos. And they play the role of right-handed neutrinos. And so the seesaw mechanism gives some relationship between the neutrinos in the standard model, the heavy neutrinos, their couplings, and the vets. So if I want to get all of the rates to work out, I want to avoid coming to equilibrium. The circular requires this f is less than 10 to the minus 7. Because it's an f to the 6th process, I want the coupling to be big so that I get a reasonable asymmetry. That typically points towards f of 10 to the minus 9. So this picks out a mass range that's 1 to 10 GeV just by plugging in these numbers. Now, the leptogenesis still happens the same way as before. So the mass splitting squared still needs to be 5 keV squared. And so what you find is that in this model, the right-handed neutrinos have to be very degenerate to about 1 part in 10 to the 10, so that you realize this keV scale oscillation in time with GeV mass particles. But of course, you can do that. There's nothing wrong with that. In terms of the phenomenology, this is also interesting from the testable point of view, because we lose our scalar phi, but we gain these n particles, which have masses in the 1 to 10 GeV range, which we can maybe look for. So this, after electric symmetry is broken, the state's mixed to the seesaw mechanism. And the mixing angle squared is typically the order of 10 to the minus 10. It's the standard Mollichino mass over the stale Mollichino mass. And that is very, very small. It's really hard to see anything that's, you know, 10 to the minus 10 in terms of, you know, rates involving standard Mollichinos are already small, and then you multiply that by 10 to the minus 10. So that's bad. However, what a lot of these models rely on is that the coupling can be enhanced if you have an approximate symmetry. So, for instance, there are things called the inverse seesaw mechanism, but they basically rely on the fact that if I have two ends and they are a Dirac pair, I don't generate any standard model neutrino masses, but I can have an appreciable coupling. So you can play with various symmetry-breaking structures, or you could just fine-tune the Yukawa coupling so there's some cancellation in the masses and pull up the coupling. So this is where the coupling sort of wants to be, but it could be larger. And so once I have this mixing, I can, say, produce this right-hand neutrino in the decays of, say, Ws, and then I can also allow it to decay. So this is definitely not a dark matter candidate. But this is very small. It's a weak process that's multiplied by the square of this mixing angle. So this model also gives you long-lived particles, right, for sort of different reasons, not for the sort of cosmological reason, but just kind of accidental combination of couplings and masses, and just that it's Friesen, so the coupling is small. So if we look at the parameter space is typically expressed as like the mass of these n particles, or one of the n particles, and then the square of this mixing angle. And the currently excluded regions are the gray shaded regions. All of these solid lines are potentially optimistic estimates of what could be probed. This is from a paper involving three right-hand neutrinos where they kind of get the maximal possible parameter space. They say not to trust too much the sort of color coding of like where things are likely to happen versus unlikely to happen. You see that I think all of the colored regions are where baryogenesis can happen. Now, this is sort of the 10 to the minus 10 level where the seesaw predicts, but if you have models where the coupling is bigger, you can potentially maybe get into this testable range. And then this bottom range here, it's either the coupling is too small to explain seesaw or there are cosmological constraints. So what are the signals or probes? So one of them is BBN. So if it lives too long and it decays during BBN, it can disrupt nucleosynthesis, and that's basically what's ruling out this parameter space here, that the lifetime, you know, the lifetime has a mass of the fifth dependence, so it's very, very steep. The other thing that you can do is try to make it directly. So BBN is kind of coming from this end, and then colliders and accelerators are coming from here down. And the LHC is, you know, Atlas and CMS are one possible way, but you can also look for dedicated experiments. These are GeV scale, so I don't need TeV energies, I just need GeV energies. So one way that you can accomplish this is through a beam dump type experiment where I take, for instance, 400-ish GeV protons from the SPS at CERN, and I dump them, and then I have a bunch of shielding, and then I have a detector. And then I just look for, you know, the shielding filters out all of the crap I get from the beam dump, and then I just look for one of these end particles that decays downstream. So this is the proposal, say, for SHIP, but there are a few such proposals. The other thing that you can do is at the LHC, the problem is you're looking for like a GeV blip in this 100 GeV or TeV scale QCD crap, right? And so what you can do is you can rely on the rock or various other things around your detector to shield that out. So what you can do is have the collision point, say, here, and then you have a bunch of stuff, and then way, way, way down somewhere far away, you put in a cavern a little box, okay? So you don't have to build the shielding, you don't have to build the accelerator, the collider, all that's already there, you just have to put a little detector in somewhere. And you look for particles that, so here the blue is a long-lived particle, and it maybe goes in and decays. So this is a proposal called Phaser that's actually been funded and is being installed. And this is specifically looking for lower mass things that tend to go forward in the collisions. This gives a flavor of the kind of ways you can probe. This is, again, the mass and mixing angle squared plot with some projection curves of what some of these proposals like SHIP, Phaser, Methuselah, which is like a much bigger, much farther away version of Phaser. Codex, is Codex on there? Yeah, this is one near LHCb and so on. So there are prospects for looking for these, but of course, you know, there's a lot of space. This is FCCEE, so that would be very much in the far future. So there's a big parameter space that's difficult to test, but you know, could be there. The discovery prospects are a bit better if I have some new things coupled to these stale particles like Z primes or scalars. And so, you know, people have been recently been saying, okay, how do we test neutrino models and, you know, B minus L gauge models and so on. The problem is no one's really looked in the leptogenesis scenario that I've been talking about the fact that these new interactions bring these particles into equilibrium. So with some students at Harvey Mudd, what we're finding is that if we do this, we can suppress the asymmetry by many orders of magnitude. This is the fifth power suppression associated with this coming to equilibrium. And so a lot of the most testable models are actually not good for leptogenesis, which is a bit of a bummer. So I'll stop there. I hope I've convinced you that in spite of the sort of complexity of the dynamics, that this simple model can generate a lot of interesting signatures, as well as explaining baryon asymmetry, dark matter, and right-handed neutrinos. I think given that, you know, this Friesen baryogenesis stuff has been around in the leptogenesis incarnation for about 20 years. And as far as we know, we're the first people who have done anything as scandalous as change the lepton to a quark. And it completely changes the order at which these things come in, the signatures, and everything. So I really think we're scratching the surface of this. So it would be interesting to see what other regimes and signatures there could be that we haven't found. So, thank you.
So this is, of course, a very nice proposal. Could you elaborate a bit more? I think you briefly mentioned, but could you elaborate a bit more about the number of parameters that are required to achieve these results, and how is the ARS leptogenesis compared versus the regular leptogenesis?
How does ARS leptogenesis compare to the regular leptogenesis? So in the ARS scenario, the number of parameters is the same as in the regular leptogenesis. I would say that the main difference is that there's this parameter that essentially allows you to adjust the overall size of the Yukawa coupling relative to the seesaw value, but still give you the masses from the seesaw mechanism. Basically comes from the fact that the seesaw mechanism is F squared and the Yukawa coupling is F absolute value squared. And so in normal leptogenesis, you typically don't want to crank up the Yukawa coupling. And so that parameter space is not explored, whereas I would say in these models, there's very liberal use of that parameter to try and take you from down here and get up there. So I would say compared to regular leptogenesis, the low-scale leptogenesis requires maybe more alignment of parameters than you might have in the normal leptogenesis. But it's, you know, you get these low-scale things that are sort of have to be there. So I think one of the things we found encouraging about the cases we studied was that there are somewhat fewer parameters, but then also just like, I don't have to futz around with any of them. They just kind of work, which is nice. I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah.
I was wondering if you had any ideas or recommendations for more targeted searches for the signature.
So the searches that you've done are already really good for the quark case. I would say basically, yeah, what this predicts is some standard model, you know, scalar partner decaying to that fermion plus invisible. And so I think historically there's maybe been a bit of bias about, you know, in SUSY spectra, which one is the LSP, and that's the one to look for. And so I think just saying, okay, all of the lepton flavors, all of the quark flavors, making sure that there's some way of at least reinterpreting it. But yeah, I'd say, we talked about this yesterday, I think taus are like the big one. But yeah, it's rare to have like slepton, like long-lived slepton, except for maybe this tau. So I know that you have this displaced vertex search for the mu and the e. And so I think same flavor would be really important here, because maybe this phi preferentially decays to like one of the flavors, and then that's the one you would see. Thank you. And yeah, for the rest of the day, if you have questions about any of the other baryogenesis mechanisms as well, I'm happy to do that over coffee and chat about them.